identified as that? No, I guess not. Okay. Well, there goes my sermon. We're in Luke chapter 8, if you have a Bible. And our story for this morning isn't so much a story directly about Sabbath, as much as it's a picture of the kind of life Sabbath makes possible. So we're here at we're here in Luke chapter 8, verse 40. Let's read along with me. Now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him. Then a man named Jairus, ruler of the synagogue, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house, because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him, and a woman who was there, who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. Then he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." While Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. "Your daughter is dead," he said. "Don't bother the teacher anymore." Hearing this, Jesus said, "Don't be afraid. Just believe, and she will be healed." When he arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She is not dead, but asleep." They all laughed at him, knowing she was dead. But he took her by the hand, and he said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. When Jesus told him to give her something to eat, her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. Here, in a frantic and anxious moment, for both the synagogue ruler and for the woman that was bleeding, but a moment also anxious and frantic for Jesus, we see Jesus fully present, able to stop and pause and to face those in need around him. We see the synagogue ruler and the woman reaching out to Jesus and finding a moment of rest and comfort. And I think what we see throughout the stories of Jesus, but also as we think about what it means for us to practice Sabbath, it's that in the practice of Sabbath, we find an interruption to our lives that often feel like we're caught up in the midst of highway hypnosis, a kind of peeling off mile after mile, time flying by, running from thing to thing, shrouded with anxiety and ambition, with crowds pressing in all around us, just like this picture we see in Luke chapter 8. Jesus gives us a picture of a different way to live in the midst of that. Sabbath comes to us as an interruption in the midst of our highway hypnosis. And it teaches us what it looks like and what it means for us to trust God with our time, to receive the time that's been given to us. When I was in university, this was back, you know, before university students took really elaborate spring break trips, you know, on airplanes and actually staying in hotels and things like that. When I was in university, it was more like you gather together whatever change you and a couple buddies have, and you see how far you can travel on that change before you have to turn around and come back. And so one year, we were coming up to spring break, and a bunch of people were heading to warm destinations, and we're in Minnesota, and there's still snow on the ground, and the days are dark, and, you know, we're just thinking, you know, we should go someplace. And so about Thursday, you know, spring break starts on Friday, about Thursday, late at night, we all kind of see how much money we have in our bank accounts. We realize we've got about $200 per person. There's three of us. $600. Where can that get us? We pulled out a map, and we looked, and we said, where's the closest warm place that has beach? And it apparently is Texas from Minnesota, straight down Interstate 35. And so we gathered some sleeping bags and a camp stove and borrowed a tent from somebody and things like that. And about probably between like 9 and 10 o'clock on Friday evening, we set out for Texas. Three of us in a car. We even had a TV VCR. One of the things we collected as we were borrowing things from various people is we found one of these plugs that you can plug into the car cigarette lighter, and you get like a four, you know, thing of plugs. And so we could plug in a TV and plug in a VCR, and we had them kind of set up in the back seat. And so we'd kind of have a movie playing, and we thought we were set. This was going to be awesome. We were going to go down to Texas. We were going to find a place where you can camp for free on the beach. We just assumed those existed. And we were just going to camp on the beach. All it was going to be was food and gas money to get down there and get back. So we jump into the car, full of excitement and energy, just going to seize the day, seize the moment, enjoy the time. We were looking forward to that phone call that was inevitably going to come at some time in the following week saying, hey, Mom, yeah, I'm down here in Texas. You're where? Nobody knew where we were going. This was going to be a sweet trip. Well, sometime the next morning, around probably, I think it was like 12 hours to Dallas, so it's about 10 o'clock in the morning, we're squinting in the Texas sunlight, sitting at a Waffle House, picking away at grits and bacon, and we pull out the map again. We're really tired. You know, the miles just kind of tick by, and the stakes kind of fly by, and your energy and excitement about the trip sort of wanes, and you got that I've been up all night feeling. And we look at the map and realize that Dallas was really almost only halfway to the beach. And so we still had about 10 hours to get to any real beach from Dallas. And we realized that we had to make a decision between the really popular beach, which we were risking that you wouldn't have a place to camp, and then kind of a less popular beach that was a little bit closer. And so we had to make a decision. If we got to the wrong beach and we didn't have a place to camp, we would be driving another 4 hours to go out and around. And so we had to make this decision. And so we're sitting at this Waffle House in the Texas sunlight with a plate of grits and bacon. If you don't know what grits are, look it up. And we're saying to ourselves, how did we get here? And where are we going? Now, that's really a metaphor for life, isn't it? I mean, let's think about this for a second. Most things in our life start out with thinking we have this great idea, or we're entering into this great new phase, or we have this great new opportunity. You know, these big transition points in our life that always start out with so much promise and anticipation. And we jump into it wholeheartedly. We have this awakening moment, and we're going to seize the day. We're going to take advantage of every opportunity. We're going to thoroughly enjoy this. You know, when we have children, or we get into a new relationship, or we start a new job, or we move into a new neighborhood. We're going to take advantage and enjoy every moment. But then the miles just kind of pile up. We get tired. What was exciting becomes a little bit mundane. And suddenly we find ourselves in a place we never really expected that we would be, and wondering how in the world we got here. Because the highway hypnosis set in. We know we started someplace, and now we know we're at someplace, and we have no idea what happened in between. And then we look at where we think we're going, and we wonder, where in the world are we going? This is often our experience of time, the passing of time, the experience of our lives as they get lived. Often highway hypnosis. And when we stop to take a look around, we have no idea where we are and where it is we're going. I'm sure we've all had those moments of sitting in a Waffle House with grits and bacon, wondering what just happened. The practice of Sabbath comes as an interruption into that experience. You see, what Sabbath does is it addresses our anxiety and our ambition. And our highway hypnosis is directly related to anxiety and ambition. Let's start with anxiety. Most of us have all kinds of ways in which we pass the time, or we even perhaps lose time. It's when we know we have an important project and instead we go on to TSN and look at sports scores. Or we watch just one more cute cat video on YouTube. That's not my distraction of choice, but I wanted to have equal opportunity here. When I walk outside to let our dog out in the evening before we go to bed at night, I can look in the corridor of our condo, the common area, and I can look at all the windows on either side, four stories of windows in our low-rise unit. And what do I see flickering through the blinds? Television screens. All of us locked away in our little, secluded, 900-square-foot condos watching television by ourselves. We pass the time. We lose time. And why is it that we do that? Well, it's one of the ways we cope with our anxiety. It's one of the ways we cope with our fear of failure. We would rather not start, so we'll just pass the time. It's one of the ways we deal with the fear that we might be sitting there with our loved one and not have anything to talk about, and so let's just watch the television instead. We often waste our time daydreaming and TV and dawdling and searching for cat videos on the internet because we're anxious. But then there's other times that ambition is what rules the way that we live our lives. And so we're simultaneously a people that know how to waste days playing video games and yet also have phones and calendars and computers that make us reachable and working almost all the time. All these studies have been done by all these different schools about multitasking. And here's the big news about multitasking. People that think they're good at it are actually not. People report that, success and how much they accomplish with multitasking. And every test that we do shows that the more things we try to fit into an hour, the less we get done, and the worse the quality of what we produce is worse. We're terrible multitaskers. We're not made to be multitaskers. And yet, because I can be working on my computer on one thing, and then a notification comes up reminding me of something else, and then I go check on that, and then I come back to it, I feel like I'm accomplishing so much, but all I'm doing is moving. But I'm not going anywhere. And so, ambition, our desire to make a name for ourselves, our desire to accomplish something, to fit as much as we can into the day, to do as much as we can, to do something spectacular, ends up fragmenting our day. And so we manage our time, and we make time for people, and we make time for things. And yet all we do is move faster and faster and faster, but we have no idea where we're going or what it's about. And our anxiety and our ambition sort of conspire in this highway hypnosis. And so we end up at a Waffle House, with grits and bacon, wondering where we're going and how we got here. But we see something totally different in the life of Jesus. In Luke chapter 8, we maybe can't all identify with Jesus' situation. I don't know if anybody's ever rushed up to you and said, "My daughter's dying, can you heal her?" But we've all had those moments where we're doing one thing, and suddenly the moment of crisis arrives. We have an opportunity to rise to the occasion, to do something really meaningful and spectacular. Here Jesus is a faith healer and a teacher and a very important person in the community. The synagogue ruler comes up to him and needs him. And there's a crowd watching. This is an opportunity to do very important and significant work. And so Jesus rushes off with the crowd. And the way Luke describes this, there's people bumping into him. And it's just this mass of people moving to the synagogue ruler's house. Excitement in the air. This is a significant moment for Jesus. This is important work. This is what God sent him to do. If this were a movie, this would be, you know, the airport scene. You know, the one where the person realizes that the loved one is going to be on the way to the airport, and he has like a 45-minute window to catch her. And so he jumps in the cab, and he says, "To the airport!" And, you know, all of his friends are trying to get to the airport, too, and they round the corner onto a street, and then suddenly it's just all like a parking lot, right? And then he jumps out of the cab, and then he runs, and then he gets on a motorcycle, or, you know, gets picked up by a helicopter, or suddenly Spock beams him up. You know, something like that happens, and he miraculously makes it to the airport and gets through security in some odd fat, you know the story, right? It's that kind of scene. Jesus, every moment matters. The daughter is dying. But in the middle of this crowd, there's a very insignificant person. This woman who's been isolated and marginalized. This woman who has been bleeding for 12 years. Who's considered unclean and untouchable. She doesn't even get a name in Luke's text. Perhaps nobody gathered it. She's invisible within a crowd of people. She goes totally unnoticed. But the minute she reaches out to Jesus, the minute she reaches out to touch the hem of his cloak that she just might be healed, Jesus stops and notices. She might be invisible to everyone else, but she's not invisible to Jesus. And this small act of faith brings healing. In this moment of urgency and importance, in this moment where Jesus has an opportunity to do something really spectacular and noticeable for an important person to fulfill the mission for which God sent him, Jesus stops. When time is of the essence, he stops and he turns around and he says, "Who touched me?" And you can just sense the urgency in Peter's response. "Well, everybody's touching you. Let's get on with it. This girl's dying." But Jesus is fully present to those around him and even to this invisible woman. He talks to her. He tells her that her faith has made her well, and he sends her in peace. And it's at this moment in speaking and in listening and sitting face to face in conversation that we realize that the delay has been too long. And so some people come from the house of the synagogue ruler and they tell Jesus that the girl's dead. "Don't bother the good teacher anymore." But Jesus encourages Jairus to trust him, to rest, that she's not dead, but she's merely asleep. And so Jesus continues and goes into the house of the synagogue ruler and doesn't make a big show of it, but just brings a couple people into the room with him. And he says, "Daughter, get up." And she gets up. And then he says, "She's probably hungry. Get her something to eat." And then he tells them not to tell anybody else about this. Scenes like this are played out again and again. Jesus is the center of activity, and yet he never seems to be in a rush. Important and world-changing events and messages are being proclaimed, and yet no encounter, no person, no interruption seems too small for Jesus. The gospel writers tell us stories about Jesus like this again and again and again, where seemingly insignificant people demand large amounts of his time. And when he's in the midst of important, big things, he stops for time with children. This woman that Luke didn't even get a name from. He's present. He's aware of those around him. He's aware of the movement of the Spirit. You see, Jesus is never really one who just uses his time well or manages his time. He doesn't seem to be one who's trying to just pass the time. He doesn't seem to be a very good multitasker because he pauses and spends time with those that are with him. People are not simply marks on the way to something more significant or more important. Rather, we get this picture from him as one who is simply there to receive the time that God gives him and to receive the people that God has given him. The whole life of Jesus is one of trust. Trust in the God who gives him life. Trust in the God who gives him community and those around him. And hope. Hope that whatever he encounters, God is there with him in the midst of it. You see, Jesus' life is not one governed by ambition or anxiety. He has an opportunity with the healing of this 12-year-old that died to make this really big and public and spectacular show like the TV evangelists. And yet he doesn't. He does it behind closed doors and encourages them not to tell anybody because it's not about the spectacle, it's about God. Even in the midst of this urgent and frantic situation, Jesus doesn't act out of anxiety and push the woman aside, but he pauses to spend time with her. You see, Jesus' approach to those around him and Jesus' approach to the time that's been given to him models for us what happens in our hearts when we follow Jesus through the practice of Sabbath. I said this wasn't a text about practicing Sabbath as much as it's an example or a picture of what happens when we do practice Sabbath. You see, Sabbath comes to us every week. It's an interruption in our lives that we don't plan for or organize or manage. It comes every week, the seventh day, or for us, the first Sunday. It comes every week. And so whatever kind of journey we're on, whatever kind of highway hypnosis in which we find ourselves, whatever demands we feel are placed on our time, whatever crowd we find ourselves caught up in, whatever urgent thing is there to be done, Sabbath comes and it beckons to us to rest, to respond to God's invitation, to come and rest, to stop, to cease, to pause. To stop doing and to pause, to breathe, to remember that the world is God's and everything in it. To be present with those around us. To be present with God. Remember, Sabbath is the time where we stop being side by side and we sit face to face around the table with our friends, with our family, with God. You see, the practice of Sabbath is a weekly interruption that helps us reimagine our time. Reimagine the flow of our week. It's an exercise of faith. We stop in order to trust. So let me encourage us in our practice of Sabbath as we think about the flow of our week to respond to God's invitation to come and to rest. And to recognize that whether we're operating out of anxiety or ambition, or sometimes both, That Sabbath is a practice that comforts our anxiety by reminding us of God's abundance. And it confronts our ambition by reminding us of God's aptitude or God's ability. See, in the story of Israel, when they were in the desert, God had this instruction. He fed them with manna in the wilderness, and God had an instruction to them that they were to gather on the sixth day double, so that on the seventh day they wouldn't have to go out and gather. And miraculously, the manna did not rot overnight, but was just as good on the seventh day as it was on the sixth. But every seventh day, still some Israelites would go out in the desert looking to see if they could score a little extra. This struggle with trusting God, this sense of anxiety that drove them out into the desert for more. And so we have that same struggle. Can we stop and trust in God's abundance? And what that looks like for us might be a whole variety of things. But I want to encourage that we perhaps stop in a way that allows us to make sure we sit face to face with others. We host others on the Sabbath as a way of celebrating God's abundance. There's something about sharing food that is a demonstration of abundance. There's enough for all. Or perhaps we stop shopping on the Sabbath. We mark Sundays by not shopping, not buying or selling. Because what we have is enough. Let's cease and allow Sabbath to comfort our anxiety with God's abundance. But some of us are driven by ambition. And so our Sabbath practice then confronts our ambition with God's aptitude or God's ability to do all that He's promised. And so throughout the Old Testament tradition, there's an encouragement to observe Sabbath as an act of freedom. That God set you free, Israel. You are no longer slaves. Slaves don't have the option to rest. But you do, because God set you free. So rest on the seventh day. This is a freedom won by God. So I want to encourage us to observe Sabbath as an act of freedom. This isn't law. This is something we are free to do. And so mark the day by beginning the Sabbath, whether you start Saturday night or you start Sunday morning, to mark the day with an act of thanksgiving, naming the gifts that God has given, naming the ways that God has proved Himself able. And then perhaps to be free on the Sabbath day to attend to the interruptions in our midst. We often miss the interruptions, see them as distractions rather than gifts. One day a week, can we respond to the interruptions? Those that might reach out for us or to us and ways that we might not expect, to respond to the requests people make, to be present for one another as a way of recognizing God's, the way that God has set us free, to be free for one another. We all have a variety of times in our life we find ourselves at a Waffle House wondering where we came from and where we're going. And yet God gives us this gift every week, this interruption to pause, to address the anxiety and the ambition that drives us, to learn what it means to trust God wholly with our lives. Most likely we identified not with Jesus in this story, but with the woman or with the synagogue ruler. And likely that's the kind of posture that we come. So let us reach out to Jesus, or let us come to Jesus, experiencing the rest that Jesus offers this day and as we go forward. Let us practice Sabbath wholly. Let's pray. Help us, God, as we think about our days and the flow of our life. Help us to pause long enough to let you speak into our anxieties, to confront our ambitions. Help us to be attentive to the ways that you might interrupt or disrupt our lives, to be present with those that are in our life already. Jesus, I pray for just moments of peace through this week, moments of encounter. I pray that you can teach us what it looks like to rest and to trust you more completely. In Jesus' name.